Welcome back to another episode of Austin Film Festival's On Story podcast. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. This week, we'll hear from David Kessler, writer and producer of the docudrama Minimata. David Kessler began his career as a stand-up comedian in the early 2000s before quickly deciding to focus on writing. After penning a spec script for Will and Grace, he switched over to drama and optioned the life rights and book titled Minimata, written by Eileen Miyoko Smith and W. Eugene Smith. The film stars Johnny Depp as W. Eugene Smith, an American photographer who documented the effects of mercury poisoning of the citizens of Minamata, Kumamoto, Japan, in the early 1970s. The film went through various stages of development over many years before finally getting picked up by Johnny Depp's production company. I recently had the pleasure of speaking with David about the film's journey to the big screen following its U.S. release. Clips of Minamata, courtesy of Minamata Film, LLC. I know this was an original story of yours. It's kind of a piece of lost history. Obviously, the photographs existed and people knew of them, but it's not a piece of history that people seem to culturally know. So can you tell us how you came across this story and what was it about it that you felt like you could make this into a compelling movie that people would want to see?
I had always been familiar with the photograph, the famous photograph, the girl in the bath photograph. Mm-hmm. Because I'd gone to Parsons School of Design, and it was always in the best of photojournalism books, the best of photography books. I even think I have a Time magazine from the late 80s or mid 80s. It was like the best of photo, you know, Time-like sort of photojournalism. But I always, since the photo was in black and white, I always thought it was from the 1940s. I always thought it was like, oh, this is the effects of Hiroshima. You know, because it's a photograph. It doesn't have any explanation. And it wasn't until years later, it wasn't until I was made aware, like, oh, no, this photo is from 1973 or 72 or whatever it is. A buddy who was older knew of the Life magazine spread. And then the more investigation I did, the more I found out about Gene Smith and his little history and his arc. Then actually, there was a book. I didn't realize I got a book out of the Los Angeles Public Library. Minamata, like it was their book. You know, some books you can't, they won't circulate it. It was reserved, you know, in the reference section. It's kind of a travelogue. And again, the more I've investigated Gene Smith, the more I was like, oh, this has a perfect three arc structure. This is like a guy who's like down and out, who had previous successes, who's, you know, has substance abuse issues, you know, who at the time, I think he had pawned his cameras for booze money and cat food. And it was just a perfect redemption story.
In 1971, the American photographer Eugene Smith had become famous for his photographic essays published in Life magazine, but he'd become a recluse. While on an assignment in Japan, a passionate Japanese translator named Eileen urged Smith to visit Minamata and photograph the effects of the disease that was ravaging its people. Though initially hesitant, Smith is eventually convinced to unmask the devastating cost of corporate greed, the inaction of the local police and government, and ultimately reveal to the world the effect mercury poisoning and Minamata disease is having on its coastal communities. Armed with only his camera against a powerful company, Smith endeavors to win the trust of the broken community and find the images that will bring this story to the world. It's a challenge, I think, to tell a faithful story about somebody who's still alive. And obviously, Eugene Smith isn't still alive, but Eileen is, and clearly involved in the process. So when you decide, hey, I'm going to tell this story, and now I'm going to get in touch with somebody who I have to get in touch with, probably to tell the story accurately, what was your hope in that conversation?
My hope was to option the rights to the book and the photography and her life, just practically. But the bigger hope was gaining her trust, which took 2 years. Because I live in LA, I had been in the entertainment industry, I was a stand-up comic, and she lives in Japan. She's half Japanese, half American. Mm-hmm. So it was a big, big leap of faith and trust to be like, this former stand-up comic who specializes in comedy is going to handle this very dramatic, personal, sensitive, culturally sensitive story. So I give Eileen a lot of credit. And then I had no produced credits. But yeah, I think that's one of the reasons it took 23 months of emails back and forth and maybe a handwritten letter and a lot of midnight Skype calls because she's in Japan. And then there were times that she was out and I had to reel her back in. It was a journey, and I give Mrs. Smith a lot of credit.
So he's an incredibly complicated character. I mean, you touched on that a little bit earlier, but I'd like to hear about what it was, like what in your research, before even you got involved with Aileen, before, what was it in your research that you felt like, I'm magnetically drawn to this guy?
He was really larger than life. He was very mercurial. He had very contentious relationships with almost everybody who crossed his path, especially magazine editors. He was very eccentric. He had real high highs and real low lows. He was obsessive. He collected newspapers and recorded things with a tape recorder and graffitied the outside of his door that said, "Do not disturb unless it's the second coming of Christ." And then, you know, written in paint underneath that was like, "Con Ed, don't turn the gas off." If he wasn't real, you could have made him up.
So I really loved a couple of moments in the film that gave me a lot of information about him and also some more compassion for him. The scenes with the young man he meets on the bench who he hands his camera to.
See this? Anyone can do this. Anyone. Takes nothing. Your point, focus, click. And most important, f*** up. F*** up. Because that's the only way to learn. So, you take it, kid. I'm sick of it.
I thought that was a brilliant moment to weave in there because it felt like it told me a lot about him without me having to expositorily find out he's just, you know, a complicated soul. Can you talk about how you were going about building that character out and things you used like that? You know, why, what you were trying to do?
Well, fortunately, that's true. The boy in the movie, the teenager in the movie, is based on a real person who was profiled in the original Minamata book. And he did sort of hang around and he did sort of pester them to learn photography. And he did, you know, sort of show up at the darkroom door and just sort of hang around and, you know, want to know how the pictures are turned into prints. And he was at the premiere of the movie in Minamata. They showed it in Minamata. He was there. And he was interviewed by Japanese TV. And he goes, "Yeah, I remember Mr. Smith." He goes, "He taught me how to take pictures."
But from a perspective of Smith's character in relation to that young man, the moments where this person who can't take care of his own children, but he clearly has some compassion for the people here, that to me is a really great, from a screenwriter's perspective, character building moment. But then obviously you have to be careful with it. So, I mean, when you were writing this, were those scenes in the original script involving him?
I always knew he was going to be sort of a major minor character, to your point, because Smith was estranged from his own family and his own children. And he had a lot of them. I think he had five children. I think there's a line in the movie where he doesn't want to babysit the girl in the bath eventually. And then Aileen is like, "Well, you've got kids." And he's like, "Yeah, it doesn't mean I'm good at them." And then she's like, "Do you have any pictures of them?" And he's like, "No, I guess I should make some." You know, it really kind of spoke to who he was and where he was then. Yeah, and it gives him an opportunity to have a proxy family.
So they spent 3 years in this town, but in obviously in the film, you've condensed that experience. And I'm interested in how you chose in this storytelling the pieces you were going to include in here and how you determined in your research what you were going to leave out.
One of the things is like, you just got to strip away everything that doesn't serve the theme. You know, there could be a lot of like interesting moments and interesting people and interesting plot lines, but it's like, if it doesn't serve Gene Smith becoming a better person, if it doesn't serve him going from being very isolated in his apartment in New York City and not having any friends or a support system or a family to him becoming a part of a community, I strip away everything that doesn't sort of tie to that in a major or minor way. So everything sort of had to speak to him becoming closer to people, becoming more open-hearted, and developing these relationships. Because in my mind, I kept thinking, like, she says, like, you're not going to get the picture that you want to get unless you get closer to these people. And I think in an early draft, he says, like, listen, I'm a photojournalist. I don't get close with people, because if I get close with people, then I'm too close and I get personally involved and I might not get the picture I need. I might get so involved in what's happening, I might not take a picture. So I like to be in the shadows. And I think in an early draft, she says, well, like, if you don't step out of the shadows and get real, get present and get to know these people, you're never going to get the pictures you need.
Yeah, well, I mean, I love that scene where he is speaking to the people from the town and it's clear they're not really wanting to participate. But his speech and finally getting some engagement from them to tell their story, you know, to participate.
I'm here to help if I can. But I need you to help me. By allowing me to spend some precious time with you and your family. So that I can help to fight your fight.
So sureba.
So, I mean, the question is this. Who is comfortable and willing to share these very precious, intimate moments?
So, you know, you write this piece for somebody who you've built up in your own mind from your research, et cetera, and then it gets handed off to somebody who's their own life force, probably equivalent to this man's life force. What does that process look like for you when you're having to now envision this character who's a really very real person? What continuous writing process occurred after the decision was made that Depp's company was going to make it and he was going to be Smith?
There was a long time where they developed it and we never talked about Depp's star. But in the back of my mind, I knew, like, this is really a Johnny Depp type guy, because he was quite eccentric and he did do great art. But then I knew Depp was attracted to personalities like Hunter Thompson and these other big eccentric personalities. Mm-hmm. And then I heard when he came in the office, there was a meeting where he was presented with the things that were being developed. And it got to the creative executive and he says, well, you know, Johnny, we've got this story called Minamata, and it's about a photographer named W.D. Gene Smith. And apparently Johnny Depp goes, I know who Gene Smith is. So apparently he had been a fan and he had been familiar with Smith's work. And again, it turns out in a weird, you know, these weird little serendipitous moments, these moments of kismet, he had been friends with the photographer Mary Ellen Mark. You remember she made a documentary about street kids in Seattle in the early 80s or late 70s. And Mary Ellen Mark had taken photograph classes from Smith in New York in the late 60s at the New School for Social Research, where I had gone to school. So there are all these like really wonderful full circle moments.
The hospital scene section, the long, you know, that long piece in the hospital, which I loved that piece, but it was also very difficult to watch. You know, is that how it existed in your primary iterations of the script? Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's the scene where they sort of go undercover and they go in the basement. Yeah, that scene was always there. There was a ward they attached to the factory. And in the original script, they do sort of sneak some cameras in. In the original script, they run into the hospital doctor who kind of brings them into the basement. And the hospital doctor, he had figured it out. The hospital doctor, a real guy, the corporation kept limiting his experiments, and he experimented on 399 cats. And then finally, he literally went to the pipe where all the sewage was coming out of it, all the waste. And he literally took like a glass jar, went back to his lab, injected a cat with the water, and then the cat had the same symptoms.
I found something.
Says the cat he fed from Chisto's pipe water reacted just like that patient. Spasms, paralysis, convulsions, Which is exactly what happened when one is poisoned with mercury. It literally destroys brain tissue. And for 15 years, they knew. They knew, Jean.
So yeah, the original script had that doctor in there, a doctor who eventually, he had cancer, and he eventually testified against the company on his deathbed. The jury and the judge literally went to this man's house and they took his testimony from his mat in his home. So, you know, we just had to be judicious about storytelling and space. What is amazing is they were able to simulate the factory, like the fact, remember they go to the top and yeah. It's got all the pipes and it's amazing.
Were you always envisioning his photographs interspersed throughout this story? Like, were they built into your script?
I knew we were going to have Gene's pre-Minamata photographs, like the Life magazine photographs, the stuff he had done World War II and the stuff he had done for Life magazine. We had more scenes of Life magazine that got cut out and hopefully will be on a DVD. Interestingly, Eileen, at some point, I don't know when this was, she decided she was going to pull the photo of the girl in the bath from publication. There was some discussion amongst them where I think the family understandably got tired seeing their late daughter, you know, they felt like it had done what it needed to have done. And then they felt that maybe it didn't need to be as public anymore. And when I first approached Eileen, and we were going through this 2-year process, at one point she was like, yeah, we can't show the photo of the woman with the daughter in the bath. And I was like, well, we might as well not have a movie. Just bluntly speaking, because I said, people have that photo seared into their heads. I mean, even people who have seen the photo once are going to want to know who these people are, why that daughter is the way she is. How did the photo come about? How your relationship with this family? And then she began to think about that and, you know, consider it. And then I believe she had conversations with the family. Now, the daughter died in the 70s, not too long after the photo was taken. So I actually, when I saw the movie, I was surprised the actual photo was in the movie. That really, like, I didn't know of that. And I didn't see that coming. And I actually didn't even recognize it till maybe the third viewing.
Well, but there were so many other photos that were part of their book that ended up clearly images in the film resurrected in another way, that it felt like, okay, some of these photos from the actual history were woven into this visual storytelling and clearly tied to scenes, written scenes. Is that what you were seeing when you were writing this film? I mean, were you seeing it woven from the stories from his book, since you actually were kind of basing it on the book in a way?
Not intentionally, but I must say, Andrew Levitas, the director, did an amazing job making everything feel so seamless, and the production designers as well, to
beautiful.
Make all of these things feel interconnected. And I believe Andrew licensed, there's a documentary that came out right around the same time as the Life magazine article.
And that character's in there, right? Like, there's a guy shooting documentary. Yeah.
Yeah. I believe Andrew licensed that documentary, and there are scenes from that documentary in the movie, but it's intercut with footage that Andrew shot. I have a hard time telling the difference.
Well, it was beautiful. I mean, it was the photography, the palette of the movie is actually really stunning and really weaved a story around it with, you know, in an arty way, what I would have expected to see if I'd walked in and just seen those pictures hanging on a wall in New York somewhere.
Yeah, I was very fortunate in a lot of ways. And it's a movie about a tough topic. You know, I remember giving the script to a script consultant, and the first thing he said back to me is this: I don't know how many people are going to watch a movie about mercury poisoning. That happened in the 1970s. He's like, you're going to have to get really lucky to find someone who has an interest and a passion in this topic and these people. And I was. I remember telling Eileen, you know, I go, look, if anything, this will just get the word out about what happened 50 years ago that many people, even my parents who probably had that Life magazine, might have forgotten.
OnStory is part of a growing number of programs in Austin Film Festival's OnStory project, including the OnStory PBS series, the OnStory radio program and podcast, and the OnStory book series. Subscribe to On Story on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Want to be in the know on the latest On Story episode? Follow us on social media at AFF On Story. On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This podcast is presented by Too Far Media, provocative stories for the eyes, ears, and imagination by Rich Chaparro. Also by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software. Find out more information about Final Draft at finaldraft.com. And by the Bogle Family Vineyards, sixth-generation farmers, and third-generation winemakers based in Clarksburg, California. Makers of sustainably grown wines that are a reflection of their family values since 1968. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts on the web at arts.gov. Our associate producers are Jamal Knox and Colin Heyer. Editing help from Travis Neely and Travis Kennedy Sound. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance comes from the Sound Lab, Inc., Travis Kennedy Sound, and KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and Conference each October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.